Good morning. I'm very pleased to be here today. As Ian said, I lived in Bristol in England, and it was with the connection of the University of Bristol and the Schumacher Institute that we formulated this project with colleagues around the world. And we're very pleased to be here to introduce to you what we're doing, and also to see many of the fantastic initiatives which you are engaged in here. And until the year 2000, I was a normal box-thinking scientist. I'm actually a geologist, you know. And in as a geology student, I learned a lot about how resources are formed, but I never learned anything about economics. Okay? And economists today, they learn about economics and they make some fictitious models, but they don't understand anything about the limits of the world, or very little, except that we have one young man here in the front, who I think does. So he's Hungarian, so that's good. So, what I'm going to talk about is to bring to you some of the urgency that we actually are in. Because there's a huge amount of things that need to change if we as humanity are going to survive this century. You know, there will always be a few people left, but maybe not that many if we continue on the path we are at. And I think the only way to change things is if we get involved individually. We don't have the time to wait for the global leaders to come to any big decisions, because as you could see from the Rio conference that ended last week, they couldn't come to any conclusions about how to change the path. So I think it's up to us. So I suspect that some of you know each other here in this room, but I'm going to ask you just to turn around and talk for a couple of minutes with somebody you haven't met before and introduce yourselves and tell them why you're here. Okay, I can hear that you're all very much engaged in your conversation. And I'm sorry to have to stop you, but we have to get on with our program. But we have a whole day, so you will be able to finish this conversation later on. So, as Ian said, we're a mixture of NGOs and universities. So we have people also from very many different backgrounds. I'm a geologist, Ian is a businessman, Jeneth is a philosopher, Harald is an engineer, and so on. So we have not only, we are sort of like a community of different people. This has not been an easy association because we all think very differently. So it has been a big learning process for us. Okay, so what we are trying to do then is to find a progress towards equity within the Earth's biophysical boundaries. And so I'm going to talk about mostly these biophysical boundaries today. Many of you have heard about the ecological footprint. It's the amount of land that we need to bring us all the resources and the food we need for our daily lives and take up all our waste. And if we look at how much land each individual on the globe has, it has been shrinking in the year 1900 with a much lower population. We had almost 8 global hectares per person, and now it's less than 2. And the population is rising, so our global hectares are shrinking. And because of that, we are now surpassing some of the planetary boundaries that scientists have identified for the planet. So 30 scientists from around the world got together at the Stockholm Resilience and Environment Center in the year 2009, and published a paper in Nature identifying these boundaries. You can see what they are. They are climate change, ocean acidification, ozone in the stratosphere, cycling of nitrogen, cycling of phosphorus, use of water, land use, biodiversity loss, atmospheric aerosols and pollution. They have actually not come up with what the boundaries are, but in order to stay within the Earth's boundaries, we need to be within this green circle here. And you can see that there are these, you know, three boundaries that we have gone far out of. Well, that is climate change. For a stable climate on this planet, we shouldn't have more than 350 ppm of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we have 390 and rising. It's cycling of nitrogen that we use in agriculture, which is affecting our waterways, coastal waters and rivers. And the biodiversity loss is very serious. We are now in an age of extinction, which is much faster than when the dinosaurs became extinct 60 million years ago. So, and we are approaching other boundaries. The cycling of phosphorus, I'll talk about that a bit later. Without phosphorus, we have no food. We are approaching the ocean acidification limits. The ocean at the moment takes up about 50% of the CO2 that is in the atmosphere. And as the ocean becomes more acid, when there's more CO2 in the atmosphere, because there's some equilibrium reactions that go on between the atmosphere and the ocean, then the corals cannot form, and other critters that have a carbonate shell. So, we really need to have a rethink of how we live on this planet of ours. And yet, it doesn't matter what we look at, whether it's population, GDP, water use, telephone, tourists, McDonald's restaurants, the curves all look the same. They're all exponential. And this is the time from 1750 till 2000. And there was an economist at the University of Boulder called Kenneth Boulding who said in the 50s, anyone who believes you can have exponential growth on a limited planet is either a madman or an economist. And his colleague, who is a mathematician called Arthur Bartlett, you can find him if you Google him. There are many videos where he gives talks about exponential growth and explains what it means. And he says that the biggest inadequacy of the human race is that they don't understand exponential growth. So if you don't understand exponential growth, you also do not understand doubling times. So if you remember anything from this talk, I'd like you to remember the number 70. 70. Think about something at 70. Maybe you have a grandmother who's 70 years old, you know, that's 70. And then you divide into 70 with the growth rate. So if the growth rate is 10%, then the doubling time is 7 years. Okay? If the doubling time is 18.5%, like it was in the Icelandic banks before the collapse in 2008, then the doubling time is 4.5 years. Okay? Of course, that banking system was going to collapse. Okay, so we have to understand exponential rates and doubling times. Okay, so can we have a perpetual growth? This is annual global production in tons of many materials that we use for our technology, as well as phosphorus, or phosphate rock, which is here. And it's growing exponentially since the year 1900. If we expect this to continue to grow, then we will reach, you know, a mass which is higher than the mass of the Earth. And that, of course, doesn't work. So, we are now reaching a peak resources. We have reached peak oil. We are about to reach peak coal. And that means we will have peak energy, because we will never be able to replace the cheap energy that we are using now, like there is no tomorrow, in a very fast rate. We will never be able to replace it with renewable energy. If you look at this curve here, This is the global energy. The peak energy will be 2020. And this green stuff here is the renewable energy that we can produce. So we will have to learn to use and live with a lot less energy. This is hydro, okay? This is nuclear. That's also limited because we only have so much uranium. And all the, we have looked at many different metals, and they all look like this. So you can take the present day consumption and divide into how much is available and get business as usual burn off rates. Or you can plot up the amount that is being extracted knowing how much there is, you can plot up these curves here. These are called Hubbard curves. There was a geologist in the United States who came up with the idea of peak oil in the 1950s, and many people tried to say that that was really the way it was because there was plenty of oil. But actually, he was right, and that we are seeing that now. Okay, so peak gold, peak silver, peak chromium, peak platinum. These are all metals that we need for our technologies. Without platinum, which is used as a catalyzer, there is no petroleum industry. There's no nylon. There are no drugs. Platinum is needed in all of that. And we have made a table with dozens of metals. So those of you who are interested in seeing that, and we have used system dynamics to look at different recycling rates and how long these metals can last. And if we use them as today, we will run out of most of them in this century. But if we start to recycle, and we have to start to recycle very fast, they will last longer. They will last hundreds of years if we recycle over 90%. But the only way to make them last thousands of years is if we reduce the population on this earth. So I don't think we will ever have 9 billion people. Just can't support them. Okay, peak fish, peak phosphate. Doesn't look good. Phosphate, at the moment, we only recycle about less than 20% of phosphate. And we have to start to capture it within the cities from our own waste. You know, this is called night soil in China. We have to start to capture it, because if we just let it go into the oceans, we will never be able to retrieve it. So this is a very urgent thing for us to do now. So we are having a huge effect on the planet because we are so many, and you can see that in the way lights are distributed at night on the planet. But the Earth is a system, and that's why systems thinking is so important. And I'd like you to focus here on this thin blue line around the globe that we can see from space. And this is the atmosphere. You can see that it's actually very thin in relation to the Earth. And this is the reason why we are now using the atmosphere for our waste disposal, because we are burning off fossil fuels that took millions of years for biological and geological forces to produce. And we are burning it up in a record time, and the planet is unable to take it up fast enough. Our forests cannot do it, our oceans cannot do it. So that's why we are changing the atmosphere, and we are changing the climate. Okay, but we do get something from outside. So Earth is a closed system, except we get energy from the sun. Some of this energy is reflected back into space, but now more and more of it is being trapped here in the atmosphere because of the greenhouse gases. And so we need to have a rethink about how we live, all of us, together. And the reason why we've gotten here is because we've been thinking in a linear fashion. We dig a phosphate in Mexico, for example. We make fertilizer in France, you know, and we grow food in Iceland. And then we let the excess phosphorus go into the rivers. But in nature, if we leave an ecosystem intact, everything is sustainable. And it's cyclic. From the soil, the tree gets their nutrients, and then the leaves fall back onto the surface of the soil, and the bugs and the little critters, they break down the leaves, and it becomes a part of the soil and food for the tree in the future. Okay, this is what we need to learn. Learn from nature. It's referred to as biomimicry, or cradle to cradle. Once you are applying this thinking to industry. So instead of having them cradle to grave, we have cradle to cradle. And many industries are now changing the way they produce things, thinking about these issues. Okay, so in our study that we are presenting here, we're using systems thinking and systems analysis. The natural step. How many of you have heard about the natural step? That's an NGO in Sweden. We have two from the natural step here. Okay. They developed sort of a scientific framework for sustainability in the early 90s, which is based on systems thinking, and also on the first two laws of thermodynamics and the law of mass balance. So if anybody says to you that there's no scientific framework for sustainability, that's not true. The natural step has it. So I find that very important to use when I talk to scientists. Because once I started thinking about sustainability, my colleagues at the university thought I had fallen on my head and said, this has nothing to do with geology. This is a political problem, you know. But we all have to engage in it. I also like to use the Atkinson compass because it provides us with all the widths of sustainability. It's not only nature and economics. It's also society and the well-being of the citizen. And in our community engagement workshops, we have used World Cafe methodologies. And we have in this project, what we're trying to do is actually a very big concept. We've focused on food because food is essential and resources that I have already spoken about. But we also have to remember that humans have needs, so we need to engage in that as well. So this is the natural step. Sustainability representation of showing how the biosphere is linked with the lithosphere, and the only value that is created this is from the energy of the sun. But what we are doing, and within that, we need to have humanity living in a comfortable manner. And what we are doing is to we are disrupting all these cycles. And we have large flows of materials, those are our resources, into society. And we are creating a lot of pollution, which goes into nature. And we are inhibiting the natural cycles. And so therefore, we have barriers to people meeting their basic needs worldwide. So for those of you who are scientists who'd like to talk to scientists about sustainability, I recommend the natural step framework. Okay, but how are we going to do this? You know, we're not going to solve this problem with the same thinking that created the problem as Einstein stated so famously. I think we need to work together. We have to, you know, look at our neighbors or our families or our company or our university or wherever we work and start to talk about what are we going to do. And look at what is our sphere of influence. This also comes from the natural step. You know, who are the people who have some power to decide and who has influence? I actually think that we all can have a power to decide. We can all, if we take it into our heart, we're going to change the way we live, then we will do it. And that's what we need to do. Okay, so there are many definitions of sustainability. As Ian said, and this comes from Alan Atkinson, who has been working on creating sustainable communities companies for over 30 years. It's a set of conditions and trends in a given system that can continue indefinitely. So we want things to be going indefinitely. And then sustainable development is a directed process of continuous innovation and systemic change in the direction of sustainability. So, and then we have to remember all the different widths of sustainability. This is Alan Atkinson's sustainability compass. We need to understand that in order to have a sustainable society, community, company, university, whatever we are thinking about, we have to remember all of these, the environment, the consumption, the government, the individual health, and so on. And only if we do that can we go in the right direction. So systems thinking is also used by Alan Atkinson to think about how we can get towards sustainability. We need to think long term. The American Indians, they thought 7 generations into the future when they were thinking about how they were going to use their natural resources. How many years do we think into the future? How many do?
Five
years? Are you a politician? Well, that's only 3 years. Are you a politician? We have a politician here at the back. How many years do you think into the future?
Answer.
Okay. Well, we have the Commissioner of Future Generations. He thinks into the future. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So we have a few people who think into the future, but most of us don't. So we need to have a rethink about that. Actually, in schools, we teach our children about 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years of history. But we don't teach them to think about different scenarios for the future. So we need to change that. We need to facilitate people to think into the future. We need to understand systems, know limits, protect nature, change commerce, show equity, and support innovation. These are all of Atkinson's steps to sustainability. And it's very important to be a systems thinker. Because systems thinkers can see the big picture, they can step back and instead of just looking at one box, they can link the boxes. They can look at cycles, they can see how things change with time because they actually are thinking into the future. They can sort of look at new angles, they evaluate the effect of short-term and long-term decisions and actions, and then they can... Oh, there's an Icelandic word here.
Yeah.
Good. Then they can find unexpected consequences. Okay, so for us, we've discussed a lot what does converge mean. Many of us think it is a step towards sustainability. Okay, so finding equity within limits. Because as Jonathan Porritt stated once, he was the sustainability commissioner for Britain. We don't have one anymore in Britain. It's a bad trend in the world where governments had good ideas and set up sustainability commissions and commission of future generations, and new governments come in and say, nah, that's not what we want to do, unfortunately. Okay. Enough. As I said before, we have been focusing on food, working with people in Iceland and in Bristol, and we are going to India soon to look at how their food system can become sustainable. And then I and the Lund, my Lund colleagues, Harald and Dennis, have been modeling resources. Okay, so why is this so important? Well, if we don't have resources and energy to make fertilizer, we have no food, and therefore we have no people. So we could say that soil and rock and oil becomes people. Okay? That's why focusing on resources and food is so important when thinking about convergence and sustainability. And what we really have to do is to think about how to close the nutrient cycles. We have to capture all the nutrients. Instead of letting them go into the oceans, we need to capture them and compost them and use them again. This is very crucial for every community to do. Even I'd like my bones to go onto the compost heap. Okay, so we have a colleague who has been working with us from the Schumacher Institute called Herbie Girardi, and he has been thinking about how to make cities sustainable. He calls the present cities Petropolis, because everything is brought in with oil, you know, with airplanes and with trains and with ships. You know, all our food and resources come in using up oil. But we need to start to produce our energy in the city, produce our food in the city, and so on. So we need to rethink how our cities are. And that is a part of convergence. Okay. And Paul Hawken, who is a very well-known American activist for sustainability, he has quoted, and he has said, the Earth needs a new operating system, and you, or we, are the programmers. It will only happen if we do it. So thank you very much.